You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, October 22nd, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report on a Michael/Sam Monday. And on today's program, we have a brand new interview that Sam conducted with Anand
Giridharadas.
Giridharadas, author of Winner Take All, on our age of extreme unequal outcomes. This was recorded on Friday. And then we've got a bunch of stories to get to in the fun half. Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudis have a new version of an increasingly bizarre, but actually you should be expecting story from the Saudi monarchy as President Erdogan promises to reveal everything within 48 hours, which is a good negotiating tactic for whatever he wants from the Saudis in the next 48 hours. Bolsonaro committed, apparently through a slush fund, mass voter illegal voting tactics through fake news spread on WhatsApp.
You expect better from your fascists.
You also might expect better from, WhatsApp's parent company, Facebook, which I thought just set up a war room to deal with these sorts of things. Apparently, not for Brazil, I guess. John Tester's race is tightening up. He might be susceptible to a Republican challenge in Montana as Democrats maintain a national edge and Donald Trump circles in on the core Republican brand proposition, white identity politics, fear, and racism, as he lies and lies and lies and lies about that caravan of asylum seekers at the Guatemalan and Mexican border. Fox, Trump, and the Republicans are going back home in an attempt to stave off a blue wave in the midterms. Plus, Tucker Carlson, we're going to get into the Carlson methodology. You'll never guess what Republican Congressman Jason Lewis is attempting to suppress in public. Richard Ojeda releases another great ad which could point the way for the future of how to flip red states, even as I just got back from doing a little bit of canvassing for Expand Idaho, an excellent Medicaid expansion project, polling very well in deep red Idaho.
Did you get a cowboy hat out there?
Next time I go out there, I said I'm gonna get on a Carhartt jacket, cowboy hat, and get a goddamn pickup truck.
I'm ready to do that. I like that.
I want to go back. I want to go back to Idaho.
Go west, young man.
I want to go back out west. So listen, ma'am, understand. You listen to under Alex Jones, and you're undereducated, but. I think you want some goddamn health care.
Is that the patter you learned?
That's what I said door to door. It's like you may have a linear family tree. Don't you?
You had
a straw
to your mouth.
I had a straw in my mouth, and I did a bad George Bush impression, and I insulted people, and pitched Medicaid. I would really recommend that everybody get out and do something like that. Whether it's door to door, I actually do. You know what? I always say like phone bank or go to a protest or, you know, break a window. No, I'm just playing. I don't say break a window publicly, but I always sort of like put all of that stuff out there. But I would say there's actually something super specifically gratifying about going door to door.
I agree.
It's an incredibly educational. It's a good thing. It'll do you good, particularly if you're feeling very bleak.
It's like going online, but in the real world.
Yeah, which is better.
Gotta stay
like
in touch.
Literally in every way, shape, and form. It is significantly better.
Yeah. People tend to be nicer IRL. Spoiler
People
alert.
Tend to be nicer IRL, and they do tend to be. They're a little. It's a little bit more complex.
I mean, not everyone.
And also, you will have occasion, like I will, like I remember, and I actually think on this show we're pretty good about kind of not buying into that sort of really basic nonsense of just like sort of, you know, doing like basic market segmentation with people, like, oh, that guy has like a, you know, a camouflage hat and a beard, so obviously he's some type of far right whatever. And I will say, like, the one of the first houses we went to, and I didn't have that much time because I was mainly there for something else. I wish I had more time. But one of the first houses we went to, this guy in the yard, it definitely hit me. I was like, yeah, this dude, he looks like a Republican. And he's just like, you don't got to worry about it. I already voted for you guys early. And Luke, my friend who's spearheading this whole thing and has this incredible team around him, was like, oh, thank you. And I'm curious, like, you know, what got you over the edge? And the guy's just like, well, that's the type of thing I vote for. I want people to have healthcare, man.
Yeah.
Like, pretty simple, right?
This is a message that can transcend party, I think.
I think the guy was actually definitely a Democrat. But yes, a story I will tell later, it can transcend party. But that's for the fun half. Let's do a nice little contrast here. Because it is actually time, and one of the reasons that maybe we don't bang on about this as much is I really do assume that if you're watching or listening to this show, you're registered to vote, you're engaged in the process, you understand the severity of the midterms, you're going to go out and vote for Democratic candidates, you're going to find the leftmost candidates you can vote for who can win, and you're going to make it happen. From district attorneys races, DA's races are crucial. I want to shout out a candidate in the fun half as well. I'll get the information up. She's running in Suffolk County in Massachusetts. That's a two Democrat race, but one of the Democrats is pro drug war, and the other one's as a real reformer. So you know this. One of the a very important race is the gubernatorial race in Florida. And not just because, in my estimation, Andrew Gillum's a good candidate who does provide something different. Again, with all the obvious caveats, which I pretty soon I'm just going to stop listing these. It should go without saying that a guy who's on the verge of potentially becoming governor of Florida is not as left-wing as I am. This is not like, I don't know how much these sort of obvious things bear repeating. But he's running really aggressively on healthcare. He's running aggressively on the environment, which we're going to hear in a second. And innately, you should care profoundly about voting rights, which are under assault nationally by the GOP and very specifically in Georgia, where there's another huge gubernatorial race with a great candidate in Stacey Abrams. And Brian Kemp's whole war is to suppress the vote of people of color. In and of themselves, they matter, and they're going to play a huge role in 2020 for flipping a state like Florida out of the Trump column. So this race matters a lot. And I got to tell you, this is the type of thing, and this is me being super superficial. Watch Andrew Gillum talk about climate, the climate crisis, and a scientific approach to it. And then look at DeSantis's, who's the Republican candidate, who is known for putting out a creepy campaign commercial, being a bizarre Trump acolyte, being on, I believe, white supremacist Facebook and internet forums, and generally being a very kind of awkward, odd, out-of-the-mainstream guy. Now, I want you to take this on two levels. One is that Andrew Gillum's absolutely right about climate. And also, if you just are observing this on a body language level, let's put on our Jordan Peterson spectacles. I was just having to talk about this guy for a weekend, which is kind of a nightmare. But which of these two do you think is the head lobster in charge? And the only way that you could think that it's not Andrew Gillum, I am going to have to pull out some race shit on you because I have no idea how else you could read this. Look at this.
Well, first, what Florida voters need to know is that when they elect me governor, they're going to have a governor who believes in science, which we haven't had for quite some time in this state. I'm not sure what is so California about believing that the state of Florida ought to lead in solar energy. We're known as the Sunshine State. At the very least, what we can do is be a global leader here. We got to teach the other 49 states of what to do and what it means to have a state that, quite frankly, leans into the challenges of the green economy and builds one and at the same time bills and economy that lasts. I'm proud that the same week that Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Accord, I broke ground in my city on a 120-acre solar farm, tripling the amount of solar energy that we produce. We're prepared to lead, and we've done so in my city, and we'll do so for the state.
That is one of the most awkward body language I've ever seen.
Yeah, it looks like instantaneous, like a time lapse of some guy getting sick to his stomach.
It looks like one guy is a confident leader speaking urgently about the future, and the other guy is auditioning for a Flonase ad. You have something else to play here?
No, I guess it's just the same clip, but with the adunctive
governor. They're going to have a governor who believes in science.
I have another theory about why.
Which we haven't had for quite some time in
Republicans,
this state. I'm not sure what is so California about believing that the state of Florida
don't like
lead
science.
In
don't like.
Solar energy. We're
known as a... So I think the theory, you know, Gillum says the thing of...
He's just staring into the void right there.
He says, we believe in science, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, obviously, we've been over this a few times. That's not really the point. The point is that Republicans are paid to obfuscate science.
That's right.
But the other thing is maybe there's another reason why Republicans don't care about climate change besides, you know, funding. That's that they are cold-blooded reptilians. Because if you look at his body language here, it looks like something out of the X-Files.
We're known as the Sunshine State. At the very least, what we can do is be a global leader here. We got to teach the other 49 states
human
what to do
face
what
means melting
that quite frankly leans into the challenges of
reptile face taking over
one, and at the same time builds
so
economy,
what is I like with this your theory mixed with the curb music would mean like he's like a really stressed reptile.
It's like a hapless reptile.
He's like not cut for the job of being a shape-shifting overlord.
No, it's like in the first scene of Blade Runner when they're giving the guy the replicant test and he just like freaks out.
That's a good call, except I love Blade Runner, but it's because he's too human.
Well, the thing about reptile brains is
DeSantis is the opposite. They're like, dude, you're
DeSantis is
get out of reptile.
DeSantis is
try
in
method
the
acting.
He's in the unenviable position of being a sort of humanoid reptilian, but understanding having some allegiance to humans and realizing that the human side is all going to be cooked. So he's
so you think he's actually having some guilt?
I think he's experiencing sort of primitive emotions. He's in like, his lizard brain.
He's like, friendly black
like,
man
what
will
is going
die.
He's having like the equivalent of like an acid trip, which is just like experiencing the shame of and horror of what he's actually representing here.
I did an ad where my son quoted from Donald Trump's book, What Hath We Wrought? Who am I? Why do I hate this nice gentleman across from me? There was a time when I tried to listen to Public Enemy. Let's talk about Audible. What would it look like if we all listened more? Listening to audiobooks motivate us, inspire us, even bring us closer together. There's no place better to listen than Audible. Because now Audible members get even more exclusive audio fitness programs, audiobooks, audio originals, and more. Audible has the largest selection of audiobooks on the planet right now. With Audible Originals, the selection has gotten even more custom. With content made just for members, every month Audible members get one credit good for any audiobook they choose, plus two Audible Originals from changing a selection that they can't get anywhere else. They also get access to audio fitness and health workouts created exclusively for Audible. Plus, your books are yours to keep. With Audible, you can go back and re-listen anytime, even if you cancel your membership. Didn't like your audiobook? Exchange it. No questions asked. Matlack, obviously, I've got to go to you on this. What's happening in Audible right now? What are you consuming at double speed?
Well, actually, today a new literary hangover dropped where I go into the Mystic Massacre, or as it's also known as the Pequot War. Mm-hmm. And in the research for that, I found a book that came out this summer. It actually might be an interesting history MR sort of thing for Majority Report. But anyway, it's called God, War, and Providence: The Epic Struggle of Roger Williams and the Narragansett Indians Against the Puritans of New England. The title mentions the Narragansett Indians, but there's a really good chapter on the Pequot, the massacre of the Pequots there. Really good reading. I highly recommend it.
That is the type and range of things that you can get on Audible. And of course, in addition to all of the bestsellers and amazing original programs, you can even get a super specific, really important, and really well-written history book like that. Start a 30-day trial, and your first audiobook is free. Go to audible.com/majority or text majority to 500-500. That's 500-500. That's audible.com/majority or text majority to 500-500. You can do it with audiobooks. Is there a noise going somewhere? No, it's not mine. I always have my ringer off. It's okay. Big corporations are getting rich from selling your data, and Congress has completely failed to save net neutrality or protect your online privacy. Now, internet providers and cable carriers like Comcast and Verizon, I believe Nas called Comcast Digital Satan. It's my ad lib. Mobile carriers like Comcast and Verizon are free to restrict websites, spy on your online activity, or sell your browsing history to advertisers.
But to help with connectivity.
To help. But with one click, ExpressVPN shields your online activity from internet and mobile providers. ExpressVPN has easy-to-use apps that run seamlessly in the background of your computer, phone, and tablet. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing history by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. Get ExpressVPN for less than $7 a month. ExpressVPN is rated the number one VPN service by TechRadar and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you ever use public Wi-Fi and you want to keep hackers and spies from seeing your data, ExpressVPN is the solution. I love it. I always emphasize it was incredibly easy to install and use. I'm not someone who enjoys technology. That's why Apple is able to take advantage of me, because I don't like to deal with it. Have it set up for me. I'm allergic to installing things. This was incredibly easy to install, incredibly easy to put on my computer and phone, and now I know that I'm not helping these companies stalk me and stalk all of us. We're doing a little bit. It's a little, it's in Douglas Rushkoff's phrase, it's a little pebble. You're getting a little bit of anonymity back. Plus, it's a much, much funner way to use services, video streaming services, and I'll just leave it at that. To take back your internet privacy today and find out how to get, you can get 3 months free, go to expressvpn.com/majority. That's expressvpn.com/majority for 3 months free with a 1 year package. Visit expressvpn.com/majority to learn more. We are going to go in just a moment to Sam's interview with Anand Giridharadas on Winner Take All.
I could sleep. On the phone, Anand Giridharadas, the author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Anand, thank you so much for coming on the program.
It's great to be with you.
All right, so give us a sense of what went into researching this book. You sort of immersed yourself, or you did immerse yourself in a culture. Just give us a sense of that to start.
Yes, Sam, I was taken by the observation I made that we live in this age of profound elite generosity, rich people giving back at every turn, signing the giving pledge. You know, when you go to the shopping mall, you see all these products that, you know, give back, shoes that are going to give back, tote bags that are going to give back, iPhone cases that are going to give back. Bono is invariably involved. You know, you go to elite campuses today, and every young graduate has a scheme to start a social enterprise that will somehow convert recycled poop into coffee. And, you know, it's all about helping and giving back and saving Africa, wherever that is, for these folks and more. And at the same time, this has been an age of persistent, maddening inequality in the United States of America. And the reality is working people and middle-class people have, in many cases, not benefited at all from the last 40 years of American economic change. The gains of the, you know, so-called fourth industrial revolution, digital revolution, genomics, the internet, et cetera, have all but bypassed them. We have a situation in this country and the world where 82% of all new wealth created last year was cornered by the same top 1% that so elaborately and generously gives back. And so I became interested in the paradox of the super elite who talk about giving back, who talk about building companies that, you know, inherently empower the masses and create community, that talk about building social enterprises that sort of solve problems through the mechanism of business rather than government. And I became interested in how those very same people who are helping are also hoarding. And I, as you say, immersed myself in their world. I'm kind of, in terms of my approach in writing, a kind of portrait artist, and I spend time with people and try to understand the world as they see it. And I decided to spend time in their world for a couple of years to make sense of how those who claim to be changing the world from the top change it in ways that fundamentally keep it the same and keep themselves on top.
And did you have exposure to this world beforehand? I mean, this, because on some level, right, there's a quality of, I feel like 15, 20 years ago, we would have called this whitewashing, right? At least in terms of watching or greenwashing, depending on what the company was, right? But this is I guess, different because we're living in an age of like the ascendance of highly concentrated wealth. I mean, we've been there before at different eras in our, in at least in this country's history. But to what extent is there a self-consciousness about it? Like, to what extent is this sincere, or I guess, to what extent is it sincere? Let's start with that.
Look, there's a spectrum. There's a spectrum from the naive to the shrewd, as Paulo Freire called it. You know, I think you have folks on Wall Street who are essentially motivated by greed and who understand that a certain amount of carefully structured, well-publicized giving can be a lubricant in the engine of continued greed. I think when you go to Silicon Valley, as I was in the last couple of days, you actually get a very different picture, which is rich people who deeply believe that they are making the world a better place and are determined to do so, and who in their almost messianic quest to do so in their way are blind to all the ways in which they are, you know, gutting the middle class and building an economy that works for too few people and siphons the gains from progress upward. You know, I think what's very striking about the time we're in is that the rich and powerful are kind of have a dual psychological reaction to living in an age of extreme inequality. And what I mean by that is, I think if you are a hyper-privileged person living in this time, you read the paper, you are aware of the era you live in, and you know that this is a time that's been punishing for millions of Americans, a time in which the American dream has stopped working for perhaps a majority of Americans. And so you know you live in that time and it weighs on you. And that knowledge, I have found in my reporting, has kind of a pair of paradoxical psychological effects. Effect number one is that it fills rich people with a desire to do something, to help, to give back, to chip in, to start a social enterprise, to engage in making this country work better for more people. On the other hand, a country that is as unequal as ours essentially raises the cost of falling out of the top. Okay, when you have a more equitable society, it's not a tragedy to be in the top 5% instead of the top 1%.
Right.
But in a country that reserves all of the good education, the good housing, and so much of life's bounty for those at the very, very top, it raises the cost of falling behind. And so that dual psychology, I think, is at the heart of what I found in the book, which is you end up with a lot of plutocrats who are A, determined to make the world a better place, and B, determined to do so in ways that do not change their world, do not change the social structure atop which they stand, do not change their opportunity to continue being winners in ways that predictably, reliably, foreseeably cause many, many others to lose.
I want to talk about the sort of the methodologies and use some examples of how we do that, but I want to circle back to that because that dynamic, right? And let's stick first with that sort of that notion of like the fractal inequality on some level having such great disparity. Years ago, Chris Hayes had written a piece about going to Davos and the pain and anguish that 100 millionaires had that their key card did not go up to the billionaires, like literally, I guess. I haven't been there, but that was difficult. And on some level, that's what you're talking about. Is there's such a steep cliff here to lose that perch that these plutocrats are developing, they're two tracks. Like how much of that is how much delusion has got to be involved in that? Or is that part of that sliding scale of sincerity?
Well, I think the delusions that I became interested in as I did this reporting are the delusions about what it takes to make things better. A lot of the folks in this kind of stratospheric club are sincere about making things better. I think I spent more time with sincere people than insincere ones. And yet they are guided in their pursuit of a better world by certain ideas about what it takes to make the world better. And what has happened is an older language and theory about how you make the world better, centered on the kind of language of power and justice and rights, on practices like building movements and seeking to change laws, change systems, change structures. That entire discourse has been kind of shelved when elites take over social change in favor of a discourse about scaling up what's good, in favor of a discourse of win-win solutions. And this notion of the win-win, Sam, is incredibly important because on the surface, who's going to be against a win-win? It's like one victory, but then two. But the reality is the win-win has become this very sinister idea in this sphere of social change. The win-win in its origin is about market exchange. You have ice cream, I have money, we make a trade, win-win. But what has happened is the win-win has metastasized into the arena of social change so that it is now claimed that social change must be a win-win, which is basically a way of saying the powerless and the left behind must be helped in ways that benefit those on top. And so what you end up with when win-win becomes a kind of requirement for change is the kind of change that changes nothing. Women who people claim they want to empower are told to lean in, which is kind of win-win feminism, instead of be able to count on the kind of actual social policies that are proven in other countries to actually empower women. We may do a win-win of a charter school that lets a hedge fund guy in Connecticut feel involved, have his name on it, sit on the board, feel like he got, a couple kids into Yale who are minorities and feel proud of himself and brag about it on the golf course on Saturday. But that's just a kind of win-win that affects very few lives in the grand scheme of the problem. Real change on that issue would be, equalizing public school funding for everybody in this country and not funding public schools according to mommy or daddy's property taxes and home value. Well, that's the kind of change rich people can't believe in, and so they tend to proffer, either unwittingly or wittingly, these kind of light facsimiles of change or even fake change that change nothing at all.
So this concept of win-win feels like a rising tide lifts all boats, and the solution to these problems is growth, but applied on some level to the concept of power.
I think that's exactly right, which is that, you know, the idea of you can just sort of have these non-zero-sum situations is based on resources. And it's often true for some kinds of resources. I mean, it's true that, you know, if we change our farming methods or cooperate in a certain way, you know, your farm can be bigger and so can mine. But as you say, you know, while resources may be finite, resources may be, you know, have the capacity to grow, power in terms of, you know, who has what percentage of power is sort of necessarily zero sum. And if you have, you know, 50% of power, and I want more power, the only way to for me to get more power is to reduce your 50% share. And what has happened in a lot of the spheres I write about, this kind of market world that I write about in the book, is that essentially the values of the marketplace and of kind of win-win change have been applied to this rather different situation of zero-sum power relationships.
Is there an analog in history where you have plutocrats attempting to both, like, sort of like simultaneously empower, but also make sure that the people are not genuinely empowered?
Well, I mean, I think you could say history is the story of different versions of that. You know, so the simplest example is feudalism. You know, if you think about the show like Downton Abbey, right, or any other kind of feudal world like that, you know, Downton Abbey, you got this one family, the Granthams, living in the castle, living on all the land. It's their land. It's their manor. And then you got all these other people. You got the servants living in the basement. You got the, you know, tenant farmers living on the edges of the farm doing the work and, you know, getting, I guess, some share of the crop. And the Grantham family is very kind and very generous. And when, you know, something happens to the servant, they are generous and sometimes, I guess, give them money or let them go away and deal with what they need to deal with. When the tenant farmers get into a bad situation, they're not cruel to them. They're kind. They're generous. But the generosity of the Grantham family in Downton Abbey does not extend to justice, because what justice would demand in that situation would be a change in the social structure that allows one family to live in the castle and own all the land, and everybody else to be servants in the basement or landless tenant farmers. So that is a classic example of how a ruling class can be generous, can be helpful, can throw scraps down from the top of the mountain, but refuses to question the situation that lets them be on the mountain and everybody else be living hard, precarious lives. And I think what is going on in America is in many ways a kind of refeudalization.
It seems to me that to some extent that we have that, you know, we've created a lot of these sort of social mechanisms in which to delude ourselves that that's not happening, right? Like, we have a concept of the meritocracy that is, that stuff is built into the cake. Like, and the only example I could use would be, you know, someone's a great baseball hitter and the idea that, like, you know, they always desired to get to the top of the heap to turn it into kickball. They're just not going to do it because real merit is when you hit the ball with a bat as opposed to kicking it with your foot. And on some level, like, the meritocracy has been this instrument, right? The power that we have is a function of merit, and it just so happens that, you know, merit made us the winners.
Yeah, I think that's right. Look, I mean, I was on a podcast with Chris Hayes the other day, and he made this point that every ruling class in history invents an ideology and a kind of common cultural, a set of common cultural assumptions, and that this kind of structure of ideas serves to reinforce why they are the ones who deserve to be on top. And this age is no different. A lot of what I'm trying to suggest are the particular ideas that this generation of super elites has spun in order to make us think that this is the system we should be living under. Because I truly believe that a lot of what happens in the world is because of illusions that we believe in common. And I think if we stop believing those illusions, a lot of new ways of making progress becomes possible.
Well, was there a difference between the disposition? Like, you know, some of these people, it seems to me, can be described as sort of consciously letting some of the air out of the tires, so that the things don't explode. Some people, you know, genuinely believe in this notion that we can expand, we can grow our way out of like a power, you know, disparity. Were the different sort of perspectives on this just a function randomly of people to people, or were there like different sectors where you would see one sort of form of disposition versus another?
I mean, I don't know. Tell me in terms of the characters that you read. I mean, what are you talking about?
I'm thinking about, like, there seems to be like a distinct quality to sort of the tech folks that have a sort of a more utopian notion maybe than others who are sort of like aware, like, I gotta kick some back to keep things from boiling over.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think they, you know, have a strong sense of wanting to maintain this illusion of them inherently making the world a better place simply by growing their businesses. Because if we all stop believing that, there's going to be a much tougher regulatory and tax environment that they face.
You also spent some time with Bill Clinton. I'm curious as to, you know, your perspective on, I mean, the Clinton Global Initiative obviously became in the course of the election, I guess, in some respects got reinterpreted in some ways. I'm wondering, like, to what extent you have a perspective on that.
You know, look, I mean, I think that I decided to spend some time with first reporting from the final CGI in September 2016, and then actually trying to talk to Bill Clinton, because I realized that perhaps no one on earth captures the arc of change in the elite idea of change as well as Bill Clinton does. Bill Clinton believed, as much as anybody in 1964 believed, that you change the world through politics, through movements, through the law, through policy. And eventually he came around to the very different view, particularly in his post-presidency, that you change the world through markets and by hanging around with rich people and getting them to give back and work in private-public partnerships with various other folks. And you make change by kind of getting the Rockefeller Foundation and Goldman Sachs and McDonald's into a room and with, you know, some local agency in some African country, and you make stuff work. And that captures in many ways the arc of how many people have shifted their view of what change is. And I wanted to understand how he got there.
And I guess I'm curious as to, like, just sort of as you get into the psychology of these folks. I mean, you were, entered into this world through the Aspen Institute. To what extent, like, is there a difference between sort of being, I guess, seduced into this world, into this mode of thinking? Because I imagine there are people who sort of enter into this world by birth, and others who enter it by luck and accumulation. Like, what what are the factors, I think, like, I don't know, were there times you felt yourself sliding into the possibility of adopting this worldview?
No, I mean, this has never been my worldview. You know, I'm like many writers. I mean, I'm not a plutocrat, nor will I ever be. But like many writers, you know, I occasionally hang around on the margins of these things because you end up at the same events with these kind of people. And that's what happened to me. And I, you know, frankly, started to be very disturbed by what I felt to be the hypocritical pretensions of a group of people who were claiming to be changing the world while in many ways upholding the very problems that they were seeking to solve.
I guess what is the answer to something like this? Is it simply just sort of a higher awareness that when we see these philanthropists, I mean, is there that we should be a little bit more jaundiced to these efforts or what?
Well, look, I mean, I think the most important thing we need to do, and that I'm hoping to wake people up to with this book, is that we need to change where we go to pursue change. All too often on the left and the right, in the last many years, when we see a problem, we think of a solution that is essentially a private solution. Well, necessarily public problems. And I'm trying to urge people to think about solving public problems through public action. And that means thinking of solutions that are public, democratic, institutional, and universal. Every time you see something you don't like in the world, it doesn't work to identify a problem and then start a cupcake company that gives back. But we've built a world and we've educated a generation of young people to think that way. And the only things that ever really improved this country came from the bottom up through movements and policies and laws that change things at the root, at the level of systems and structures for everybody. And we have to go back and reclaim that change-making heritage. And I think make sure that the end of the Trump era, whenever it comes, is not just the end of one president, but the end of an era of phony billionaire pretensions and the birth of a new age of reform.
Anand Giridharadas, the book is Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hard cosign on that one. Really, really good book. I want to say thank you to I was at this Jordan Peterson conference. I'll talk about it more some other time. There's a couple of good pods that we did, including one with Doug Lane and C. Derek Varn, myself, on the anti-PC industry and how it sort of fits into this, but also obviously some internal looking at the left's tactics and strategy and failures of approach as well. But the main thing I want to say is that Andrew and Bella, thank you, who helped sort of show me around Boise before I met up my buddy Luke and got me a place to stay and everything, along with all the organizers, David and everybody else in the event. You probably can't see this because this is like Gorka's Vichy Ren.
Vitezi Ren.
But Andrew, who is an organizer and a great guy, he and Bella, great people. Everybody says so. Organizer for Boise DSA, and he gave us all pins, which were, I think we're all, do you guys have yours on? Yeah, we're all proudly wearing our Boise DSA pins. So I don't know if it's showing up on camera, but I want to thank Andrew and Bella, give a shout out to the Boise DSA crew who are doing, along with actually a lot of people, including, I keep saying Expand, Idaho, and my friend Luke with the Medicaid campaign, and the folks at Boise State. There's good things happening everywhere.
Hell yeah. Is this like a referendum or a ballot measure?
It's a ballot measure.
Oh, hell yeah.
It's a ballot measure. So, and what's interesting, I talked to another gentleman from South Carolina who's trying to do the same thing, but in South Carolina, it's a process where it goes to the governor and then the governor can like mess around with the word. Like it, this is the way it's in Idaho is they wrote it, it passes, it's law. And if and the legislature can try to gut it, but it's much clearer. It's like, we gave you this, and if you try to touch it, that's a betrayal of the initiative. So it will get Medicaid, if it succeeds, to tens of thousands of more people. And there definitely are the only Republican who's up front statewide and opposing it is the candidate who's running for lieutenant governor, who's apparently like so extreme that it's one of those scenarios where the centrist Democrat might win the lieutenant governor's race. The current incumbent Republican governor is being super evasive on it because he does not want to go out on the record as opposing a Medicaid expansion. So
they're evasive.
It's one of those good issues. Yeah.
Like it's one of the most frustrating things in observing politics is the Republican evasiveness to owning the type of just brutality that they're trying to inflict through health policy.
Absolutely. He also, you know, the other thing too is it gives you a real ground level experience of how the Koch networks operate, because like while there is definitely not like a Democratic Party machine in Idaho, that anything that like people might have seen or experienced in New York or Massachusetts or California, he said, you know, there's sort of like an old boy Republican network that's extremely conservative, but they sort of fit in the sort of more of the genteel, you know, basically wealthy ranchers and potato farmers who are also Republicans. And then, you know, the Kochs dump so much money in that like they do have, you know, paid operatives in obscure parts of the state. And it makes they're very seductive to local journalists, as an example, because they'll shoot you a press release and you don't have to do your own research on, you know, an important ballot initiative. But this is how they're debunking that mythology, by literally going door to door and debunking it. And as you might imagine, you know, while some of the stuff that, you know, you might hear door to door is very bad on immigration, as an example, you never hear any normal person like going, I just want to help the job creators.
Yeah,
that,
no.
That is not a preoccupation of pretty much any normal person.
Or I don't think I deserve health care, so nobody deserves health care.
No, that's another one that has not been reported. So big ups to Idaho and all the people there, and shout out to Boise DSA. I wear this pin with pride. On yesterday's Michael Brooks show, Gene Bajelon and I did a systemic sort of run through of Bernie Sanders' foreign policy address, which at Johns Hopkins, which was significant. He actually really is turning his systemic critique, and it is a systemic critique of American oligarchy to a systemic critique of global oligarchy, and actually joining the twin pillars of rising authoritarianism and the ecological meltdown, and joining them in critique. And it's, you know, it's impressive stuff for a United States senator and a serious presidential contender. And we went through it and connected it with Daniel Bessner, who's also recently been on TMBS, about the work of what an actual left-wing foreign policy looked like, getting rid of the platonic ideal of national security, a whole bunch of other stuff. There's just so much content that we've done at TMBS at this point, from illicit histories in Congo, Jamaica, the European Union, Iran, Brazil, introductions to the theories like the Gotha program, CLR James, plus that long form show every Tuesday. Tomorrow, Brian Mayer of Brazil Wire. We're talking about what's happening in Brazil, obviously. And I'm also going to do a rundown of Jeremy Corbyn's proposal to give workers the opportunity to transition companies to public ownership as part of the labor manifesto. It's pretty fascinating stuff. In the very near future, Richard Wolff's coming into studio to join us and confront David Grisham on his attempt.
Smack talking.
It was pretty intense when we met in Idaho. So we'll see how that plays out.
You met
out.
Richard Wolff?
He was the keynote at the event.
Oh,
we talked for a while.
Hell yeah.
He's awesome.
I like Dick Wolff.
That's why he did that video, I assume, right? That
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
What
was
actually
so good.
Really funny was he did a great talk and only 3 minutes. Like he literally did 3 minutes where he was just like, I don't know about psychology, so I won't comment on it. I know about Marxism, and he's embarrassing. Anyways, here's the actual things that are happening in the world.
Nobody breaks it down like Richard Wolff does.
He's awesome. And really excited to have him on. That's going to be happening in the next couple of weeks in studio. Patreon.com/TMBS. Jamie, what's going on?
Yeah, so this week on the Antifada, we recorded an episode yesterday with our friends Sham and Andy, two guys who are involved with the new Commune magazine, which seems very cool. I've really liked a lot of the stuff that they've had so far.
That is, sounds very cool.
Yeah, we talked to Sham Khanna first, who's the editor, a little bit about their media project that they're doing with Commune. And then we talked to our friend Andy Battle, who wrote a very good article on why the New York City subway sucks so bad.
Why do they suck so bad?
I mean, in a nutshell, it's sort of a really good example of the inherent tension between public spaces in general and public transit and freedom of movement as a basic human right and public good, and as a site for capital accumulation. So that's basically the problem in a nutshell. It goes back to the subway's entire history. We talked a little bit about that and what it means.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
History of the subway.
Yeah. And what it means for people in other places as well, because we don't just want to be a New York-centric show. And ended with some calls to action about the public transit as a potential site of struggle.
Sweet. Awesome. Matt, you have already teased us a little bit with some major developments in the Literary Hangover universe.
Yeah, so let's check in with our good buddy Stephen Crowder.
By violence? You can look at any historical account of even the most one-sided battles and find that they were still just that. Battles!
So that's Stephen Crowder. The first part got cut off, but he said, genocide by violence? Of course that never happened here. Look at any battle, even the most one-sided ones, and they were just that, battles. Well, I took Stephen Crowder up on that challenge, and I looked at the very first battle in New England between the Pequot Indians and the Massachusetts Bay colonies. And it turns out it was a genocide. If you want to hear the story about that, I have it here.
Battles like the Holocaust.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Well, yeah. In his like, for Crowder's logic, if a single Jewish person killed a Nazi, then that was a battle.
They did.
Exactly. I think I saw a Daniel Craig movie
yes,
to that effect.
Yeah, exactly.
There's violence on many sides, people.
There's violence on many, many sides. If you saw Inglourious Basterds, they did, that was very rough stuff.
Released today, The Mystic Massacre and Pequot War. And I did it solo. That's why it came out a little bit later.
Solo track from Matt.
Yeah, I was a bit nervous, but I'm happy the way it came out. So check that out on Patreon.com.
Oh, nice. You got your sign in. Look at that.
Or
122.
Yeah.
You're on your way, buddy.
I'm about halfway there. When I get to 200, 250, or so, 250, but I might do it before that. I might start Twitch streaming, folks. So if you want to see me game,
you're going to play a lot of music.
Become a patron button.
That patron button.
My plan is to like play the episodes out for like the first hour of game playing, and then I'll comment it on it with my buddies and take questions. And
that's
have,
cool,
like,
but you should play some music as a sort of middle finger to YouTube is what I'm thinking.
Oh, on Twitch?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. We'll just play like a full like...
just have like a whole like instrumental
Jamie
set.
Album.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's, because F YouTube. All right. The phone lines are on, which is a reminder to all of us as much as everybody else. And the IMs are open. We will see you in the fun half. But first, I got to tell you this. Congress has completely failed to protect your online privacy, and now big corporations are getting rich from selling your data. But with one click, ExpressVPN runs seamlessly in the background of your devices, shielding your online activity. Protection costs less than $7 a month. To take back your internet privacy today, find out how you can get 3 months free. Go to expressvpn.com/majority. That's Express. ExpressVPN.com/majority for 3 months with a 1-year package. Visit express.com/majority to learn more. We'll see you in the fun half.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands
up. Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.